Hey, gang. Welcome to National Bugle Radio on the Rents. I'm sorry. On Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org, RBN. And today I have a guest who is from a show on the Rents Network. That's why it was in my mind. His name is Don Advo. We will be having him join just a minute. I'm just trying to get that information now over to Mr. T to bring him in. Not working quite so well. I was just talking to him a second ago. This would be how you do it. And let's see. Okay, we are almost there. And we're going to be talking. Don Advo, are you with us? Not quite yet. Okay, we'll get it. And here we go. Don Advo. He's coming. Welcome to the show, Don. Don Advo, are you with us? Okay, we will be... there we go. Okay.
Hello.
That's good. How are you today, Don Advo?
Pretty good. Are we on the air?
We are on the air.
Oh, cool.
There's a little bit of suspense there, but we're...
Well, greetings.
We're on the air together. And, of course, when I was substituting for Farron a couple of years ago, Don, you were on with me pretty much every week. Do you recall? And then those Saturday nights talking to our...
I do recall. Yeah, every Saturday night, yeah.
Yeah, and you were very popular. And usually when I have a guest on, often it's pre-recorded, but even if it's not pre-recorded, I get selfish and want to keep the guest to myself. But because you had such a rapport with the RBN audience, I'm going to... invite callers. The RBN number is 1-800-313-9443, 1-800-313-9443, if you have questions for Attorney Don Advo. But in the meantime, we have some issues we want to talk about. And just now we were talking off air, and you're talking about the case of this academic, I guess he's deceased now, but he was from Wellesley College. Isn't Wellesley where Hillary Clinton went?
Yeah, Wellesley is Hillary Clinton's alma mater. She attended there and wrote her famous 69-page senior thesis about how much she admired the guy, Alinsky, Saul Alinsky, the guy who wrote Rules for Radicals. Mm-hmm. And she talked about how much she admired him. And then, of course, later she came to within a heartbeat of being president of the United States, which is very frightening. Very frightening to think that someone who had that view of an outright Marxist and a criminal. Saul Alinsky was involved in a discussion. He worked for Al Capone for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And he was involved in a discussion. They were talking about hiring a hitman to commit a murder. And they talked about how expensive it was to hire somebody from out of town. And Alinsky said, well, could we just hire a local guy and get it done more economically? So the guy was, what do you say, he's a criminal. And he took many of the things he learned working with criminals and applied them to the idea of social activism, which mm-hmm. which is, I suspect, one of the reasons he said such an appeal to Hillary Clinton, because she basically was a sociopath and a criminal and pathological liar, among other things. But, more to the point, Professor Tony Martin was an African-American college professor, Dr. Martin.
Mm-hmm. And was he teaching at Wellesley when she was there?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think he came after she did.
Okay.
I found out about him because he died. He's dead now. He died in, I think, 2013. And he retired in the Caribbean, I think on Jamaica. But I first found out about him several, probably 10 years ago. He was a guest speaker at a David Irving history conference, I believe in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he talked about the Jewish role in the slave trade and his own issues with Jews. He was also a guest at a Paul Fromm-sponsored event in Toronto, Canada, and he spoke at length on something called the Jewish Onslaught. And what happened is he was doing research at Wellesley College. He taught black studies there, and there was a book, I don't know who wrote it, it was called The Secret Relationship Between Jews and Blacks, published under the guise of the Farrakhan organization. I don't know who the actual author is, but it talked about the Jewish role in the slave trade and the Jewish role in a number of aspects, reflecting on relating to black people, to African-American people. And it wasn't very flattering. The gist of it was Jews were very heavily involved in the slave trade. They owned ships. They funded money, and they were heavily involved. And he cites one Jew in particular named Lopez, who was in Rhode Island, Providence, Rhode Island, I think. And he had this huge fleet of ships that were heavily...
Perhaps Newport. Newport was, I think, the headquarters.
Whatever. Newport, Rhode Island. I'm not that sure about it. But in any event, it kind of struck a chord with me when I heard him make that reference, because years ago, going through a garage sale, I found a pamphlet on famous Jews in American history, and it was like a child's thing that was made to be used. And it talked about great Jews in American history, and one of them was Judah Benjamin, the Secretary of the Treasury of the Confederate States of America. But another one was a ship owner in Rhode Island named Lopez, and he had this huge fleet of merchant ships that plied the transatlantic. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, that's very interesting. What kind of cargoes were you going to be bringing back across the Atlantic from Africa to the Western Hemisphere in the late 1700s? Well, of course, slaves. So they didn't mention that in this Jewish publication promoting Jewish patriotism and all that sort of thing. Not a single reference to that. In any event, his talk with David Irving, and you can find these on YouTube. Just go to YouTube and type in Dr. Tony Martin or Professor Tony Martin, and you'll get a whole page of listings. So you can see these talks, these presentations yourself, and they're very, very interesting. I really commend them. He did a talk with David Irving on the Jewish role in the slave trade, which is very interesting. They were heavily involved. Jewish households owned slaves at much higher rates than white people did, and obviously much higher rates than free blacks who also owned slaves. There's that. Then there's one called the Jewish Onslaught. And this is a talk that he gave at an event at which he was introduced by Paul Fromm in Canada. And he talked about what happened to him as a result of his one of his classes. He lectured about the Jewish role, and he used this book, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. And the Jews found out about it, and then there was a Jewish... demonstrators came and they disrupted his class. They tried to get him fired. And then he wrote a book later called The Jewish Onslaught. I think there were two volumes. In any event, I haven't read the book, but I did read his account of it. And what he did is he marshaled all these. He said he was stunned to find out that there were so many white people who were on his side in this event. And he was getting emails from white people and letters from white people about Jewish power and Jewish this and Jewish that, and he was stunned to find out that so many white people were on his side and taking his part in this. But he also talked about how young Jewish scholars and black studies professors all kind of came together and unified and fought back, and he was able to save his job at Wellesley and ultimately prevail through all of the mudslinging that came against him. And he talked about how there were some other black studies professors at Wellesley who came out and condemned him, and they immediately received funded chairs, academic chairs. That's a not a literal chair. It's a position a chair. I mean, you're, you know, you have a position and a title, and I don't know what really goes along with it. In any event, it's a highly prestigious thing. And he said, Wellesley College is generally seen as a redoubt of the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. But he said, in fact, almost all of the administration is Jewish. Almost all of it. So you see an interesting, you know, we've all heard these stories. Many of our people have been victims of a similar Jewish onslaught. But it's very, very interesting to hear a black man talk about the Jewish onslaught. In any event, in both of these events, there was a question and answer period, and you can tell the white people in the audience admired him very much, and they went out of their way to be flattering and obsequious and fawning and, you know, show all their appreciation, like, oh, this guy, you know, maybe he's black, but he's on our side in this event. And I remember his tone and his attitude in these two events was very diffident, very courteous, very understated, almost very, very quiet, you know, like the poor black underdog picked on by the Jews. Which at a certain level, that's actually true. But then I watched another video, several videos actually, on YouTube, where he talks about the Pan-Africanism. Dr. Tony Martin, a Pan-African century. And with this man is what's called a Pan-African. And they believe African people should all unite and come together and fight back against the white man. And I heard a couple of these lectures where he talked about black nationalism. And he was talking to black groups. And the first thing I immediately noticed was that his whole attitude sounded different. His voice was different. It was stronger. It was aggressive. There was a certain belligerence to his voice. Gone was the timid humility and the soft-spoken victim that we saw in the David Irving presentation and in the event hosted by Paul Fromm. And this, he was very muscular, and he talked about Marcus Garvey and the need. Marcus Garvey was, of course, a very famous black nationalist. He was born in Jamaica, came to the United States in the early teens, and he organized the Negro Self, the Negro Improvement Group. I don't recall the exact. I don't recall the name of it. It was the Negro Improvement League or something. And he tried to organize a steamship line, and he had a convention, and 26,000 people came to that convention, and they elected him as a black leader. And so Garvey is an interesting person, if for no other reason than that he was a black leader who was actually elected and chosen to be a black leader by black people instead of by Jewish news media and Jewish people.
And he's somebody that David Duke refers to often.
Yeah, he is an extraordinary person. I've done a little bit of reading on Garvey. And Garvey was very much at odds with the NAACP, with the integrationist wing of the black movement. He had some dealings with the NAACP, and he very quickly realized it was run by Jews. It was a total Jewish operation, top down, top to bottom. And Garvey advocated a very, very aggressive self-improvement agenda for black people. He said we should have our own businesses, our own organizations, our own, you know, I mean, it was an agenda that any person could respect and be proud of. He was really not a big on integrationism, and he was well received by white people. There were white organizations that worked with Garvey, and later Garvey very quickly ran afoul of the NAACP, and ultimately Garvey was charged with I think mail fraud or tax evasion, some bureaucratic type of infraction, so they could criminally prosecute him and ultimately deport him out of the country. And that's what happened. The judge at that trial was a Jewish Zionist named John Mack, very heavily, a federal judge who was very heavily involved in trying to create the Jewish state of Israel, as were Brandeis, the first Jewish member of the United States Supreme Court, Benjamin Cardozo, and Felix Frankfurter. These men used the powers that they had on the Supreme Court and in the lower federal courts to advance separate and distinct racial interests of Jewish people in complete defiance of their oath of office, which was to uphold the Constitution of the United States. So they use their power to engage, among other things, in nation building on behalf of the Jewish community. In any event, the political lobbying, the political pressure against Marcus Garvey did not come from the Ku Klux Klan or the Aryan Brotherhood, or certainly not David Duke. It came from the NAACP. So that's a very interesting factor, and he seemed very much aware of that, is the hostility between the Jews and the blacks, and he points out how the Jews used the blacks to further Jewish interests, and anytime any black person deviated from that, they came down on him like they came down on Marcus Garvey. So he talked about Marcus Garvey's theory, and it was based on race first. And race first is a very, very muscular form of racial ethno-nationalism. And I found myself having a great deal of respect for this, for the way that he aggressively put it forward. And he said, race first means that, race first. But there was another dimension to his talk that was very... a little disturbing at another level. He talked about the Nat Turner slave revolt in Virginia and how, you know, a handful of slaves slaughtered a couple of black families, and as they were riding away, they heard a baby cry, and they went back and killed the baby. And he spoke with pride of this. This is an example of black courage and black determination. They went back and killed a baby in the crib. I mean, I can understand how you would want to kill the slave owner, and maybe he wouldn't be too merciful on his wife, but to kill a baby in a crib, and there's something very chilling about that. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me of a book I'd read about the history of Haiti by another famous black historian, C.L.R. James, who was also a Jamaican. And he came to this country, and he was ultimately deported because he was involved in a lot of communist partisanship in the 1950s. But he talked about how the leader of that country, the former black slave and black slave owner, Toussaint Louverture, sent mixed messages to the black Haitians when he told them to be kind to white people. He should have slaughtered more white people so he would have gotten his message out more clear.
Yeah, Don, so, I want to ask you before you go on much further. So for Marcus Garvey, I mean, Marcus Garvey talked about a tension between Jews and blacks.
Right.
And when I've been to a number of political meetings in the course of my life, some of which were attended by blacks, and you do have not in the official leadership of black America, but in the politically active grassroots level, you do have you certainly have this undercurrent of resentment towards blacks, towards Jews. So, from your reading of Marcus Garvey, who would have been, we're talking about what, the 1930s, maybe?
No, before that, he was deported. He died in London, England, but he was a great admirer of Hitler and Mussolini. I think he died in 1940 in London, or early in World War II.
So, you know, so what I'm talking about is currently this undercurrent. How overt would this anti-Jewish sentiment have been in the time of Marcus Garvey?
The answer to that is, the short answer is, I don't know.
I don't know. How prominent was Marcus Garvey in the black community vis-a-vis, or as opposed to, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, if that's how we pronounce his name nowadays?
Okay. I get the impression Du Bois wasn't necessarily that popular with rank-and-file blacks. He was kind of like one of the talented tenth, and he was a professor and all that, and he wrote books. And he was a Communist Party member or something like that. I don't get the impression Du Bois was that popular with the rank-and-file. He was more like a, you know, an intellectual guy, whereas Garvey was very popular. He got 26,000 black people together at a convention and got himself elected as the president. He organized a couple of companies, and he that was the reason they came down on him, is that he was so successful. He did promise. Now, W.E.B. Du Bois was never criminally prosecuted that I'm aware of.
No, he was, and he was wasn't he the token black in the NAACP leadership?
Yes, yes.
Which was otherwise purely Jewish.
That's right.
That's very interesting.
That's absolutely right, and that's absolutely interesting. I had studied Garvey's misadventures before, but it was very interesting to hear him referenced, and I'd never heard the term race first. But boy, isn't that a great sentiment, a great attitude. In any event, he talks about Dr. Tony Martin in this lecture, and you can see this on YouTube. It's called Dr. Tony Martin, A Pan-African Century. It's about an hour and 20 minutes. And I really commend people in your audience to go to YouTube and listen to these lectures, to the one that he gave at David Irving's event and the one he gave at Paul Fromm's called The Jewish Onslaught. And then listen to how he spoke in front of a black audience and see how the whole attitude is completely different. And you hear this hatred, you know, understated, but still very discernible hatred of the white race and white people. And white people wiped out the indigenous peoples in Tasmania. He brought that up. I mean, this guy's mad about what happened in Tasmania, you know, what, 100 years ago, 150 years ago?
It would be, 200 years ago. And, of course, Tasmania had a population of maybe about 8,000, maybe. And it's the size of Virginia. And the population was so sparse because these were the most technologically primitive people on Earth.
Yeah.
They were Middle Stone Age. I guess they must have reached there by boat, but then forgot how to build boats, technology. I think they forgot how to create fire. They could only carry fire around with them.
Yeah.
And so any encounter they were going to have, even if it was going to be with the more technologically advanced Aboriginal Stone Age people on the other side of the strait, any contact they would have with outsiders was going to be disastrous. And it was disastrous. And you can't defend the British who were there. But, you know, when the encounter happened, you have to remember, this was an encounter with pioneers or maybe even convicts. And so not necessarily a reflection of the thinking in the homeland in Britain. These were people who were so far separated. I mean, a message going back and forth to the Home Office would take months, if you're talking about 2 years ago.
I'm not here to be an advocate for the Tasmanians. I'm simply pointing out these people, even the ones like Martin, who come off as our friends and who are polite and courteous, when they're talking to their own kind, it is like the difference between Jekyll and Hyde, between night and day, and we need to be very, very careful about trusting these people who, with their own kind, openly proclaim their hatred. Who gives a damn about what happened in Tasmania 200 years ago? It's like, you know, we need to go forward, and we need to get past that. There were 500,000 black slaves in Haiti, and 40% of them were owned by free blacks. You know, they always want to talk about the Jews and the whites. They don't want to talk about the role of their own people. And Henry Louis Gates has produced a number of documentaries on black history, and they're very much worth watching. And he talked about the slave trade in Western Africa. And he says flat out, the reason they exported slaves is the African kings who fought each other like drug cartel leaders over the right to export slaves is that the African economic model could not produce anything else that could be exported. The only thing they had to export was their own damn people. So don't tell me about the Tasmanians 200 years ago. Right. The African slave trade went on for hundreds of years. And, you know, they need to clean their own, they need to really do a reassessment. They are not interested in going forward. They are not interested in racial reconciliation, whatever the hell that means. Well, I'll tell you what it means. It means white extermination. And in this weird Darwinian kind of world we live in, where everything is called by a name that is the exact opposite of its true meaning, mm-hmm. reconciliation means white extinction, white extermination. And I think, I know your audience that listens to this is a very, very, you know, sophisticated audience on these issues. And that's why I strongly advise, recommend they watch these particularly these three videos, easily accessible on YouTube, to see how these people are. And we need to exercise great caution mm-hmm. in trusting these people and regarding them as friends or allies or anything else. Because there is a hatred, a deep-seated hatred in the black, in all peoples of color, all of them. They all hate white people.
Yeah. Now you can work with people without trusting them. I think your point about not trusting or being careful about trusting that is sage advice. But of course, it doesn't preclude working with people, or even if not working with them. The acknowledgement that we're facing some similar problems, facing some similar adversaries, and are going to be working in the same direction.
Martin is eminent. Martin and his scholarship is well worth studying. His work on the Jews is very, very well worth studying. Also, his encounter with the Jews and his fight with them is very interesting. And It shows how people can cross over racial lines and help each other. Like, he expressed his surprise that so many white people were interested in helping him when he had his misadventure with the Jews. But to hear this man's hatred, it really makes you wonder, you know, how far can we go with these people? Mm-hmm. This is a guy who proclaims his admiration for blacks who killed a white baby in the crib, you know?
Right. Yeah, and the fact is, there is just a lack of realism on the part of so many blacks, because if they got what they wanted, I guarantee you they wouldn't be very happy.
Well, no, they wouldn't. They wrecked Rhodesia. I mean, mm-hmm. Rhodesia can't even feed itself now. They don't, you know, they want reparations and they want all this compensation, but they don't seem to realize that when you kill off the people from whom you're trying to collect all this money, you're not likely to collect it. And the great cities of our country are falling apart. They can't run these cities. Here in Los Angeles, after the Watts riots, they gave them a brand new hospital, Martin Luther King Hospital. And the federal government had to shut it down because of the malpractice and the low standards. You know, they had a college in Compton near Watts, where the famous Watts riots occurred. They shut it down because of corruption and because of poor academic performance. So they can't run one hospital, and they can't run one junior college, a two-year college. Mm-hmm. What in the hell are they going to do with a major city?
Right, and of course, all the talk, well, look at what they've done with Detroit, and there's your answer.
Yeah.
Oh, I think we'll have plenty to talk about on the other side of the break. We'll be coming up on a break in a matter of seconds, and there's plenty to talk about, and anybody wants to join the conversation, 1-800-313-9443.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to aroutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech. Quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AirOutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield Tactical Bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AirOutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AirOutfitting.com.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Welcome back to the show. Welcome back to National People Radio. This is Patrick Slattery with Don Advo on Republic Broadcasting Network. We've been talking about racial issues. And just before going to the break, I made the comment that I think if blacks got what the black leadership wants, or what the blacks, the bulk of the blacks want, they would not be very happy with it if they got their way. It's, you know, I hate to, I don't mean to be comparing them to children, but, you know, if you're familiar with children, children want to stay up later, they want to do this, they want that, and they want things that aren't good for them. And this, to a large extent, is really what we're dealing with. If they got their way, they, you know, where they get Whitey out of the way, they wind up with Rhodesia or Cape Town, where they're about to run out of water to drink, or Detroit, where everything's falling apart. Now, there are black individuals who are have higher capable cognitive abilities, and for an individual like that, who, you know, Don, you've said many times, you've talked on this show about, I guess it was Martin Luther King's wife who wound up escaping her black neighborhood with the help of Oprah Winfrey to live in a white neighborhood. And right. For those who have the means of escaping and the capacity for functioning in white society, as an individual strategy, the best strategy for them would be to try to assimilate, not just to whites economically, but to assimilate to their values, which would, but instead what you find, and, you know, how much of this is just instinctual to them, and how much of it was a result of Jewish conditioning and programming, I don't know, but what you find is those who get the education, get the opportunity, then rather than assimilating to white norms and white values, attack them, attack whites. They come into a corporation as the you know, the diversity officer, and then go about trying to establish a beachhead for invasion. They try to attack whites with the privilege that they've been given. What are your feelings on that, Don? And then we do have a caller I'm going to want to get to.
Sure, but. Sure. A big problem in the black community is not dirty, rotten white people coming to the black community and shooting black people. It's other black people shooting black people and other minorities shooting black people. That's certainly the case here in California, but all of the hatred is expressed toward white people. I mean, look at Ferguson, Missouri. Ferguson used to be a great little town, and the blacks all moved in, and the school is in the toilet. They have a great black hero named Michael Brown. Michael Brown, we have on video, robbing a store. You just walk in and take merchandise off the shelf and walk out without paying for it.
And shoving the little South Asian merchant who tried to stop him.
And then the cop says, get out of the middle of the street and walk on the sidewalk. And he attacks the cop and tries to grab the cop's gun. So, you know, what do you do with people who do not respect any norm of civilized behavior? You know, if you want to hate white people, that's great. But you don't try to attack a cop and take his gun. And when you go into a store, you know, you pay for merchandise. How long can civilization last when there is no respect for the most basic norms of civilized behavior? The answer is not long. Mm-hmm. And it didn't last long in Ferguson, Missouri. Once, you know, they got aroused and started burning the place down. It didn't last long in Detroit. It doesn't last long any place blacks go. It's never lasted very long in Haiti. There's an interesting story. During the Civil War, Lincoln acquired the rights to an island off the coast of Haiti. And he thought this would be a great place to set up a colony of free blacks. Okay, so they sent a ship down there with provisions and, you know, everything that was necessary to start a fledgling colony. 6 months later, the colony failed, and they had to bring everybody back. What the hell is that? I mean, we're not talking. You look at the pilgrims who landed in November in Massachusetts in the middle of a very harsh, howling winter, and they survived in spite of a very harsh winter, in spite of a 50% mortality rate. They had to fight in tooth and nail for every calorie, for every bit of survival, but they survived. They prevailed, and in a matter of a year or two, they were a very prosperous colony. Now, I've been to the Caribbean. I mean, I've never been to Haiti, but I've been to Nassau, and I've been to the Cayman Islands. They don't have winters there. Okay, there's no frostbite. There's no blizzards. It's a very benign climate. I mean, the water is almost bathwater temperature, for God's sakes. And if these people can't create a colony in the Caribbean that is going to be productive and prosperous, what in the hell? And, you know, in the 1800s, what in the hell are they going to do today? I don't know. I don't have any hope for reconciliation. I have zero hope. I just don't think. I want separation. Give them Detroit, and let them. And when they burn it all to the ground, and when it finally collapses, and they perish through epidemics and famine and whatever, we'll move back in and take it over again. But
right. Well, you remember George Lincoln Rockwell proposed giving them Brooklyn and Miami Beach. Okay, we have William from Montana. William, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Don.
Hi.
And Dr. Slattery, always great to hear your analysis. I always miss when you're not on some program that I can listen to, because you really have a great breadth of understanding of these things, and you talk.
He certainly does.
With a lot of authority, and it's very hard to get into this without just feeling like you're walking into a room full of molasses on the floor, you know. You can't hardly say anything about this that doesn't lead to just like pulling teeth. You know, when you talk about Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X and even today Louis Farrakhan, I mean, who are their enemies? Is it the white people or is it their own people? I mean, if you look at their histories and all the things that happen, it's, you know, black against black. And all of these, you know, Garvey and Malcolm X and Louis Farrakhan, they all advocated that there's no way to have, like, a solution in integration, that there needs to be a first step, you know, a segregation and taking responsibility for their own lives. And, you know, I you know, you were talking about you know, Saul Alinsky. When I first dropped out of college the first time, it was like in the mid-60s, and I got a job working for a black organization. It was a neighborhood house, and I got a job because the government said, you're administering these federal funds, but they're all in black areas. You've got to open up a branch in a white area. So they opened up a branch in this poor white neighborhood, which was called Southern Appalachian Migrants, which was where I was born. And so I got a job without knowing anything about anything in my early 20s as a community organizer. And quickly, a group of ministers in the region got together and they said, hey, we want to send you to the ultimate organizer, the guy who can teach you how to do your job the best. And he's in Chicago, and it was in 1968, and I was all for it. I didn't know who Saul Alinsky was, and I said, yeah, I'll go, because I wanted to go to the Democratic convention that was happening in the summer. And as all the ministers knew that I was this anti-war, Vietnam War protester, and they said, oh, that'll be fine. Saul Alinsky will love that. You know, he loves people who have strong feelings like that. Well, to my credit, on the very first day that I end up in Chicago at this training camp, Saul Alinsky kicks me out. And he kicks me out based on my last name, because he asked me, he said, you're a German, aren't you? I said, well, you know, my parents, both sets of parents came over in 1860s, and, you know, I think of myself as American. He said, yeah, but you're German. And I said, well, maybe. And he said, don't try to hide it. And when I told him, when he read something that some minister had recommended me, he said, and don't you dare go down to any of these protests. You know, anyone who protests the Vietnam War is out of this program on his ear. Well, the very next day, I actually went down to the, you know, the aquarium where all these war protesters were, and he found out about it, and he kicked me out again. And so, to my credit, you know, that's, you know, that I come recommended by the fact that I didn't last longer than 2 days with Saul Alinsky. But it just shows how strong this sort of hatred that is used to get us all worked up against each other. And, you know, why should we have this conflict when, you know, one of the simplest ways of dealing with it is, you know, we each go our own way and try to make the best of the people that we relate to. And that just is something that just isn't allowed anymore.
I believe that the 1960 census, which was still keeping track of national origins, I believe that Germans were the largest single ethnic group in the United States. I would imagine maybe they've been passed up by Mexicans now. And that's amazing that the largest, I mean, the English are large too, but the largest or one of the largest ethnic groups in the United States is just completely banned by Saul Alinsky for no other reason than because of their ethnicity. I mean, that's amazing.
And he laid
and then also that he didn't want you to demonstrate against the Vietnam War.
No, and he threatened any of these ministers. He announced that us, you know, there were about 12 of us in this program. I'm supposed to go on for 10 weeks. And he said, I own you. I own every, he said, this idea that you come to these meetings, he said, I own you even when you're not here. And if anyone violates that, they'll be out on their ear. And he was very condescending to, the ministers loved him because it almost like the more they heaped this, abuse on them, I was appalled at, how they loved it. They felt that they had to atone for their sins. And he emphasized that community organizing was completely amoral, that it had nothing to do about love and peace or anything like this. It was about being able to manipulate people to get what you want. And, and he really resented young people. He felt like all the people down there protesting the Vietnam War, which was, one of the major things that happened that August in, Chicago, wasn't worth the powder it would take to blow him up. And I saw just how virulent his hatred was. And this guy was held up as being, this great person of raising the poor up by their bootstraps. And I didn't get that impression at all. He was actually a demagogue in the way he treated people. And I was happy to be booted out. The ministers paid for me to stay there, and I just became a full-time war protester, on their money. And then I went back, to my job.
Did you go to the convention, the Democratic convention in 1968?
Oh, you couldn't get near it. The closest I got to...
Well, you were in Chicago at the time.
Yeah, and the closest I got to the convention hall was when some of Mayor Daley's Jeeps with barbed wire, on the front, on these wooden contraptions that they attached to their police jeeps, started pushing me down the sidewalk, and I realized what the Daley machine was all about. It was a very eye-opening for a 22-year-old kid or something like that. It was very eye-opening, and it was very eye-opening to see Saul Alinsky in the light that I saw him.
That's a fascinating story. Don, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, that's interesting that you actually met the great man himself. I'm not sure when Alinsky died, but that's a very interesting experience.
1972 age 63.
Yeah, well, I never knew much about Alinsky. I did read Rules for Radicals and a little bit, but no, I wasn't much of a protester in those years. I was kind of pro-war, so we would have been on opposite sides of the issue in those days. But
yeah, it's interesting that people on opposite sides back in those days. How many of us have come over to the other side? I wouldn't be considered a pacifist any longer.
Some of the, like Dr. Duke, who at the time supported the war, he looks back and thinks it was a mistake. And at the time, I would have been for many years, egalitarian, a racial egalitarian, and reality kind of forced me to wake up. And I think we all have to, is there anybody who can survive to age 70, for instance, or 60, or even 50? Without really having to rethink some of the things he's thought in his life?
Yeah, and I that was when I first started awakening with difficulty to just what an insidious and nefarious influence, this Jewish influence, because if you were there in Chicago, the dominant leaders, the youth leaders, were predominantly Jewish, it was almost like I started waking up to just the way they treated each other and how they demanded to be the leaders. If anyone showed up, even though they had credentials, of being at the front lines, they were pushed aside in a very unceremonial, ceremonious-like way. It was like, no, you will not be on the podium. No, you will not get to speak. And I saw a really top-heavy, and then, even Saul Alinsky, said that, he loved berating these Christian ministers, for their Christianity, and saying that it was a real impediment to progress and he didn't care about love and all this stuff because it just got in the way of getting the job done. And I just started seeing the cracks in this leadership, this predominantly Jewish leadership that said, we will be the leaders. You know, you will not, even though you've paid your dues. And that was the beginning of my eyes opening up to that very insidious.
Yeah. You know. Hey, we're going to break. Do you want to hang on? And we'll finish this up after the break.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now, but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
With Don Advo and William from Montana. William was telling us his experience in Chicago in 1968, being kicked out of a study group by Saul Alinsky. You mentioned the very Jewish leadership of the, I guess, the Chicago rioters. Not all, you know, my memories of Vietnam War demonstrations, and I grew up going to these things, was a lot of middle-aged women. Not a lot of radicals, but the radicals sure took the they took the headlines. And you think back to the Chicago Seven, and three of these names are household names, pretty much, or were household names for a while. There was Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Tom Hayden. There's there's another Jew among them, Lee Weiner. The other three I don't think were Jewish, and there was an eighth conspirator. Bobby Seale, the Black Panther guy. What do we make of it? You had an anti-war movement that had lots of students, lots of mothers, parents of draftees, a lot of like kind of bedrock middle America opposition to the war. Yet these Jewish radicals took the headlines with, you know, a lot of criminal activity. What do we make of this?
And, you know, one thing that I remembered very graphically, I didn't realize the significance of it when it happened, was I don't know if you remember that, you know, both Dan Rather and Walter Cronkite were you know, actually attacked by security guards inside the convention because Dan Rather tried to talk to a Georgia delegate, and he was immediately pounced upon, you know, by security guards. And then Walter
Cronkite.
We're
under the command of Mayor Daley, I suppose, right?
Right, and then all of a sudden, you know, Walter Cronkite goes over there to try to interview Dan Rather, and they had their mics on when Walter Cronkite was saying, "Hey, wait, you know who I am?" And they were throwing him out. And one of the things that they said when Walter Cronkite later interviewed Dan Rather about this expulsion from the Democratic Convention, he said the whole dialogue in the country is the peaceniks versus, you know, the decent people. And he said, isn't it amazing that we finally are the recipients of this thing that they try to say it's them against us, and here we are just trying to report on the Democratic Convention, and we're thrown outside. And I didn't understand the significance of that, but that was when the nation started, had their first, observation of just how deep this division was and how much control was being exerted on what we thought were, you know, supposedly free elections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My thought has always been that the people who were for the Vietnam War, many of them probably had very good reasons. I think it's because of, you know, communism and everything that communism had meant earlier in the century. But in a way, we're kind of shutting the barn door after the cows had left. The damage was done. But Don, I'm going to give the last word to you. We have about a minute or so left.
Okay, well, go to YouTube and type in Professor Tony Martin and watch these videos. And I think you'll find it's very illuminating. You'll learn a lot about the Jewish role in the slave trade, a lot about the Jewish role in American politics and suppression of black nationalism, and a lot about what a lot of these people, mm-hmm. These black people, really think of us and how they really speak about us when they're with their own kind.
Okay, great. And check out the RBN archives. You can always listen to this program again if you missed something, and we will be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.